Last month in Dallas, this weird thing happened. It was Friday night, April 7th. It was a clear spring evening, not many clouds, you could see the moon. And at about 11:30 p.m., this started happening all over the city. There are 156 warning sirens in Dallas, and every single one of them went off, which, you know, during tornado season isn't unusual, except that it was totally clear that night. So people were confused and actually took to YouTube to document it.
Stupid thing's going off again. Third time now.
This is terribly freaky.
I was like, is this the tornado
sign? No, it's a tornado sign, but there's nothing. There's no stupid
like
weather whatsoever.
Nothing around.
Do you hear them? Like, I'm legit triggered right now.
Hearing it could be some kind of civil defense test, right?
People started calling 911 to try to figure out what was going on.
We had around 4,400 calls coming to the 911 call center.
Then at around 1:20 a.m., after an hour and a half of wailing, the sirens turned off.
Oh man, they just stopped.
It turned out there was no emergency. No tornado. The sirens had been hacked. The next day, the Office of Emergency Management had tracked down the vulnerability, the Dallas mayor pledged to find the perpetrators, and life went on. But the episode was also a reminder of a hidden system all around us. Not just in Dallas, but all over the country, there are emergency systems just lying in wait, ready to wake up millions of people in the middle of the night. I'm Flora Lichtman. This is Every Little Thing from Gimlet Media. I'm here with producer Catherine Wells, and you brought this story about the Dallas sirens.
Yep, I'm from Dallas, so I'm always, you know, keeping up on my Dallas news. But I was so fascinated by this because it got me thinking about all of the emergency infrastructure that's around us all the time that we just assume will be there when we need it.
Like what?
Like, okay, we're sitting in a studio right now. There's an emergency exit sign that would light up. There's a fire stairwell that we could use. There are sprinklers. I did check. There are sprinklers on every ceiling. And then if we were to go outside, there would be sirens and storm shelters, and there's a national 911 number we can call. And they're all just sitting there latent. And so I started to wonder, you know, are there other emergency systems that I don't even know about because those emergencies just haven't happened to me yet?
Are there?
Well, I called a guy who I thought could help us answer that question.
My name is Craig Fugate. I'm best known as the former administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency under President Obama.
I heard that Obama called you his security blanket. Is that true?
Yes, he's called me many things. That was one of the better ones.
What are the worst ones?
The president has a very dry sense of humor. He would tell me I'm doing a heck of a job, and I would cringe because that was the same thing that President Bush told Mike Brown in the middle of the Katrina response.
Oh, burn.
Oh, yeah.
So FEMA is in charge of warning you about all sorts of emergencies, the kinds you would expect.
Floods, tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, cyber attacks, disease outbreaks.
But also ones that I didn't really expect.
There's things like geomagnetic storms, which we call space weather.
And what about asteroids?
Yeah, we've actually been working with NASA on a detection and warning system.
And Craig told me that a lot of the emergency alerts and warnings that we might not think of as necessarily related are actually all a part of the same big system.
The big title for it is the Integrated Public Alert and Warning System, or IPALS.
This national system includes everything from, like, an Amber Alert you would see on the highway on a road sign to an extreme weather alert on TV or radio to the kind of flood warning that shows up on your phone. All these systems are run jointly by FEMA, the FCC, and NOAA, and integrated with local systems.
Okay, so this is IPAWS, and IPAWS is this master control system for alerts.
Yeah, it's like a big umbrella for a lot of these smaller alert systems that operate more locally. So that's our system. But for a long time, we didn't even have this. I mean, obviously, for most of human history, our alert systems were like, you know, a bell or something. But the first time in the U.S. that we got a national connected system was during the Cold War.
During an alert, keep your portable radio tuned to the Conelrad radio frequencies, 640 and 1240 on the AM dial, for the latest reports and advice.
It was called Conelrad, and Truman started it in 1951. One of the basic purposes was to have a way for the government to communicate emergency information with the public.
Learn first aid and home emergency preparedness steps. And learn how to use Conelrad.
Conelrad got to people through AM stations on the radio. And then in 1963, JFK established the Emergency Broadcast System, or the EBS. That system included radio and TV, and it started broadcasting local alerts, too, not just national emergencies.
This is a test of the emergency broadcast system. The broadcasters.
If you were watching TV between the 60s and the 90s, you would have heard these tests.
This concludes this test of the emergency broadcast system.
So this is one of those systems that you might not think that much about. Unless something went really wrong.
It was a very normal, mundane Saturday morning.
This is George Worrell. In 1971, he was working at his college radio station at Penn State.
I was this wire nut.
This particular Saturday morning, it was February 20th, he dropped by the station because he wanted to check on the test of the emergency broadcast system. It usually happened every Saturday at 9:33 a.m. And the way it would work is they had a teletype machine.
This is where all radio and television stations got their news.
And messages would be typed out by the machine onto this roll of paper.
Teletype paper, it was typically canary yellow.
And they'd basically get a message that said, this is a test of the emergency broadcast system, with a code word confirming it was a test. And this morning at 9:33 a.m., George is sitting by the teletype machine.
It starts typing the alert. Type, 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 type. And normally it would say, this is a test of the emergency broadcast system. On this particular morning, that's not what it said. The message said, this is not a test. This is an activation. This is an activation. Code words, hatefulness, hatefulness.
Code word, hatefulness. Stations kept a red envelope with a list of codes in it that was only to be opened in the event of an actual emergency.
Wait, so basically every station in America, like including this tiny college radio station, had a red envelope in it with code words on it?
Correct. And so this came out of the teletype machine. It said code word hatefulness. They have to find the red envelope, open it, and look up the code. And the word hatefulness means this is real. That also meant that radio and TV stations all across the country at that very moment were getting the exact same message.
I was running errands going into town. I was in my car, a 1968 Gold Charger. It was a muscle car.
This is Beth Newman. She was hundreds of miles away in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
And I was basically in the 1300 block of West Jefferson Avenue. Had my radio on. Whoa, whoa, which is what most of us in those days listened to in Fort Wayne.
This station has interrupted its regular program at the request of the United States government to participate in the emergency broadcast system.
It wasn't too long after that that Bob Sievers came on the radio and said, we're not sure what's happening. Stay tuned.
We do not know the cause of this emergency notification, but we ask you to stay tuned. This is Bob Sievers. I'm checking the wires. I'll be with you the moment we have further information. We will cease all commercial.
We were in the midst of the Vietnam War. There was a lot of unrest in the country.
It was scary. It was scary.
At this point, at the microphone, I know of nothing to cause this.
We are and it's like, this is not the way things are supposed to be. What do I do?
We ask you, please, please do not call us to ask what is the matter. We are endeavoring to find out ourselves.
Okay, so this happened in 1971, but what was the emergency? Like, I've never heard of this.
Right, you haven't heard of the famous 1971 national emergency?
Right.
Yeah, the reason you haven't heard about it is because there wasn't one.
Because of the timing of it, I quite frankly believe this had to be a mistake. And then the teletypes came up and said, you know, cancel, cancel, cancel. This is a mistake.
That the Air Force at Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado put the wrong message on tape. Put the wrong taped message. The normal tape explains the message as merely a test. And so, if you think this hasn't been something here at the studio, the Air Force evidently...
I was very happy to hear Bob Seaver's voice. And him telling us it was an error, we didn't have to worry about it. It was just relief. Okay.
After the break, how the government tried to minimize human error in the system, and what would happen in an actual national emergency. We left off talking about this 1971 false alarm. Catherine, what was behind it? How did this happen?
Yeah, so it's pretty simple. The guy in charge of it picked up the wrong tape and put it in the machine.
Really?
Yes. Like, he didn't pick up the test one. He picked up the actual emergency one. There were interviews done with him afterwards, and he was like, I don't know how this happened.
Well, they shouldn't have kept them next to each other.
Yes, that was one of the, like, fixes afterwards, was they moved the emergency tapes to a different location. But that's not actually the most alarming thing about this episode.
Okay, well, what is the most alarming thing about this?
Okay, stations all over the country got this message, but of those stations, 92% did not alert their listeners, including Georgia's station at Penn State.
Why?
Well, there was an FCC survey done afterwards where they broke down everything that went wrong in this episode. And there were a lot of different reasons, including people were confused, they didn't know what to do, it was the same time as the regular test. But what it did reveal was this huge flaw in the system, which was that it was relying on the individual decisions of thousands and thousands of people, including someone like George, who's like a college student, you know, who happened to come into the radio station on a Saturday. And every single one of these people is deciding whether or not this message is real.
That seems problematic.
Indeed.
Ultimately, it always depends on a human somewhere who is fallible and can make a mistake.
All right, so does our system today, does IPAWS fix this problem?
In part. So today's system, the IPAWS system, is much more automated. Public safety officials get trained by FEMA, and then they're authorized to use the IPAWS software system. You basically put in the alert and where it is, and IPAWS takes care of pushing out the alerts to whoever needs to get them.
So is this how an Amber Alert or a flood warning gets to my phone?
Yeah. Amber alerts and weather alerts are part of this system. They started getting to cell phones in 2011. And the way they work is they go through cell towers. So every cell phone in a particular area will get the message.
Okay, so when I get a flood warning, someone has issued an alert, IPAWS gets the alert, IPAWS sends it to the cell tower sends it to anyone in the danger zone.
Right, which is good. Our system today removes some of the decision-making middlemen in between the public and the government, but there are still human beings involved in this, and it's everyone who's getting the messages. It's basically like now everyone is George from the college radio station. Like, everyone gets the message and then has to decide what to do about it.
The fundamental human response in America to receiving a 90-character long alert is, what the blank is that?
So So this is Dennis Miletti. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Colorado at Boulder and the former director of the National Hazard Center. He studies disasters.
I have no allegiance to any particular hazard or disaster.
All kinds of disasters.
I've studied flood warnings, warnings for volcanic eruptions, earthquake predictions, tornado warnings, hurricane warnings, terrorism warnings.
So Dennis has pioneered this subsection of sociology that focuses on the language that we use to warn people. And he helped to do one of the very few studies we have on the effectiveness of these text message alerts that we get. And what he found is that getting people to react to these is really hard.
Communicating is one thing, but getting people up, walking towards the station wagon, now I'm dating myself, to evacuate is something else.
Okay, so he's saying that the problem is that people often do nothing.
Right. And I want to be clear that these alerts do definitely save lives. But a lot of times the information is confusing or it's not really clear what a person is supposed to do. And in those cases, Dennis said a common reaction of people is just to, like, mull over the situation and hang out.
Human beings are wired in the following way. We honestly believe we're safe. People sit there thinking it's not going to happen to them. Let me give you an example. While all the forest animals are running away from the flames, human beings are in their backyards talking to the neighbor over the backyard fence, trying to find out what's going on and making sense out of the situation.
It seems like this human tendency to not want to engage with life-threatening risks would make it difficult to create effective emergency alerts.
Yes, this is one of the major problems in the design of warnings is you have to overcome this instinct to ignore. You have to craft the alert so that it will pierce through that somehow, that resistance. And both Dennis and Craig have ideas on how to do that. And one of the ways is just to create stronger language. Like, it's not enough to just say flood warning in your area. It's better to say something like,
a flood is about to happen, a wall of water moving 80 miles an hour that will put water up to the height of the rain gutters on your house.
Well, what if your phone, if we issued a warning and we had like a geofence around the areas we were having flash flooding, and you started driving in that direction, and as you drove into that, your phone would start telling you, turn around, don't drown.
Yeah, I mean, wall of water moving 80 miles per hour towards me, don't drown. I think I would respond
yeah,
more to that.
Yeah, it's motivational, definitely motivational. But that assumes that you even get the alert. Because the other thing about this system is that you can opt out.
Really?
Yeah. I actually have no idea how.
I'm going to go to my phone right now. Notifications. Here it is.
I'm looking at my phone, too. It's a section called Government Alerts, Amber Alerts, Emergency Alerts. They're both on my phone. We're not turning them off. But Flora, here's what this phone is not telling us. It's hiding something from
us.
What?
What is it?
There is one type of alert you cannot ignore.
This is the one thing that nobody gets to opt out of.
You don't even have the option to turn this off on your phone.
That is the presidential warning message.
The presidential warning message.
This is the legacy of the Cold War. We maintain on behalf of the executive office of the presidency the ability for the president to address America during a time of crisis across all these warning systems.
It's designed for the president to be able to talk to the public within 10 minutes of an emergency. And on your phone, it would be a text message saying, tune in to radio or TV for a message from the president.
It has been tested, but it has never been activated, which in my book is a good thing, because if it is activated, it will be, as we in the business would describe, the worst day in America.
What are the scenarios under which that might be used?
Nuclear attack. It's kind of almost like a taboo subject. People don't want to talk about it. But as North Korea keeps forcing the conversation, it's not something that you can continue to ignore.
So this isn't a sort of far-off apocalyptical scenario. It's a thing we really need to think about.
I'm more concerned about as necessarily an intentional start to a war, but something that occurs that was not intended, that escalated fast. It doesn't necessarily have to be an attack on the United States, but I would not be surprised to see a nuclear exchange occur in my lifetime.
That is really scary and kind of a shocking thing to me anyway for the former head of FEMA to say.
Yeah.
It also makes me wonder, what could the president say in that scenario? Like, what practical alert could the president issue if a nuclear bomb was headed my way?
I asked Dennis that same question.
No words out of a president's mouth after a nuclear attack is going to calm anybody. If we just had 10 nuclear bombs take out Chicago, New York City, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Seattle, Houston, Dallas, etc., do you think it's going to be possible to calm anxious nerves?
Right. Well, I wonder, I mean,
it's insanity.
But Craig, the former head of FEMA, thought that there were some actual practical things that could be helpful even in this scenario, and that an alert might actually be able to do some good depending on how close people are to the blast.
Well, if you're in the area of direct impact, there's not much we're going to be able to do for you. For the people that are not in the area of direct impact, getting them off the roads and getting them into more substantial buildings on the lower floors, similar to what you do in a tornado, can actually change outcomes and save more lives.
Saving more lives is the point of alerts. But alerts can't keep us from doing risky things in the first place, like living on coastlines or in big cities prone to terrorist attacks, or in Dennis's case, and remember, this is an emergency warning expert, living on a fault line.
If you were here, I could take you to stand on my roof and we could see the likely epicenter of the next great Southern California earthquake from my rooftop.
The thing that Dennis has done is prepare. He has bottled water and canned food and emergency supplies spread all throughout his house. But his emergency prep kit is customized.
I enjoy a martini every evening, so I have a portable ice cube maker. And I have my favorite gin wrapped in bubble wrap. And if I go through that earthquake, knowing we'll be isolated and on our own here in the desert for 7 to 10 days, I want to have a cold martini every evening.
Well, your house sounds like the place to be in the event of an earthquake.
Well, the best place to be in the event of an earthquake is somewhere else.
Right.
Okay, so have you packed your cocktail shaker and ice tongs and flares yet?
I actually haven't. But I do plan to now, based on this episode. I'm going to get a go kit, and when the alert comes, I want to be ready. And I'm really more of a whiskey person anyway.
Every Little Thing is produced by Flora Lichtman with Christine Driscoll and Gofen Mbutubwale. Our senior producer is Catherine Wells. Our editors are Devin Taylor and Alex Bloomberg. Scoring by Martin Crane. We were mixed by me, Dara Hirsch. Special thanks to Nicole Pasulka.
Also, we wanted to give a shout out to the historyofwowo.com website, which had some really great info about the 1971 emergency broadcast. And you can find us at ELT Show on Twitter. And also thank you to everyone who sent Fact Buddy ideas. The facts have been amazing. If you have a fact, email us at elt@gimletmedia.com. Also, before we go, if you liked learning about measles and the quest to eradicate it last week, we recommend checking out Startup. They just released an episode about the small biotech startup that's trying to beat the pharmaceutical industry to a huge breakthrough, the universal flu vaccine. It is a really cool look at the intersection of medicine and business, and you can find this episode of Startup wherever you get your podcasts.